Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the court. We have one case this morning, United States v. Thompson. Captain Moore, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Captain Schaefer, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well, then. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court. May it please the court. Appellant requests 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
The government controls the charge sheet. Special findings matter. And an appellate court cannot affirm on a different theory. These are three basic principles that an accused relies on, but that's not what happened here. The government chose an aiding and abetting theory. When the defense raised concerns about perpetrator liability and notice, the government confirmed it was only a prosecuting appellant under an aiding and abetting theory, not a reckless killing by appellant theory. The military judge then adopted that framework in his special findings and found that appellant aided and abetted Sergeant Craig. But the Army Court did not affirm those findings as written. It changed the theory and affirmed on a different ground that appellant was a perpetrator of involuntary manslaughter. That's not appellate review, that's appellate revision. Even if this court sets aside the theory switch, the findings still fail on their own because the military judge never identified what offense appellant intended to facilitate or what appellant had full knowledge of.
Captain Moore, I think that serves as a good jumping-off place for a discussion here. Now, I think it's safe to say that this is a complicated case. This area of the law is murky, and then we have to apply that murky area of the law to the unusual facts of this case. So as a result, it's difficult to ask just simple, quick questions and at the same time manage to fully explore the contours of your argument. So what I need to do is ask you some compound questions.
Yes,
but I want to provide you with a roadmap of where I'm going with this so that you'll be better able to respond to the questions I do provide to you. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to first pose a hypothetical to you and then get your view on how the law should apply to that hypothetical. I'm then going to ask you to compare and contrast that hypothetical to this particular case. Make sense to you? Okay. So the first question I'm going to ask you, just so you'll be thinking of it as I talk about the hypothetical facts, is whether under this hypothetical, the accused would be guilty of a violation of Article 128, assault by offer. So in this hypothetical, let's say that the accused knows that person X intends to confront a victim with a firearm. Nevertheless, the accused knowingly and willfully facilitates person X's ability to engage in that confrontation, and the accused conduct was culpably negligent. And finally, person X indeed causes the victim to reasonably fear immediately bodily harm. Under that scenario, would the accused be guilty of violation of 128? And if not, why not?
Under that hypothetical, Your Honor, the problem with the aiding and abetting piece and the culpable negligent piece is that the accused cannot specifically intend to commit that 128 offense by being culpably negligent. Now, if that was not under the realm of culpable negligence, since the accused knew that he was going to help X commit the assault, if he had the purpose that he was going to help facilitate that, then he would be guilty of an aiding and abetting.
So as long as he had the specific intent to engage in the actus reus of aiding and abetting, then the accused would indeed be guilty of an Article 128 violation.
He would have the full knowledge and specific intent to go commit a crime, Your Honor. So under that hypothetical, as long as he had the full knowledge under Rosemond and the specific intent that he knew they were going there to commit that specific crime, or perhaps a different crime, then he would be guilty of Article 128.
So please compare and contrast that to the actual facts of this case. Why is it that appellant was not guilty of a criminal offense?
The military judge never identified the criminal offense, Your Honor.
Let's say for the sake of argument that the military judge had done so. Let's assume for a moment that the military judge said in the course of the special findings, very specifically, I find that the accused appellant is criminally culpable for the offense of assault by offer. Where would we stand then in this case?
Then we would stand that the accused had full knowledge that they were going there to commit an assault by offer. So we are now in the realm of aiding and abetting. So if the military judge makes that specific finding that he knew they were going there to commit a crime, even if it wasn't the specific crime that ultimately ended up happening, that's where we get into the realm of cases of Jackson, where we're talking about different degrees of culpability. But what the military judge didn't do in this case was find that Specialist Thompson had any intent to go commit any crime. What the government is trying to do here on appeal is to add in that finding that the appellant had full knowledge and purpose that he was going there to commit a crime. That's why the military judge's special findings fail under aiding and abetting, because the military judge only found that he was probably going to commit the crime.
But wait a minute. The military judge found that appellant knew Sergeant Craig intended to confront the victim. That was a finding. Now, to go to your point, the military judge also said intended to confront and probably kill, but we still have that finding of appellant knew Sergeant Craig intended to confront. That goes to the issue of assault by offer.
But that's not what the military judge found. It was confront. Confronting is not a crime. And the probably kill. This is all talking about.
But you have to put it in the broader context. You have Sergeant Craig, who is angry at the victims. He's got a motive to confront them. He goes with a firearm. He makes comments. I can't remember the exact wording, but they've got to go or something along those lines. The military judge, looking at these facts, determined that appellant knew that Sergeant Craig was going to confront him. And then you have all these other important facts.
Yes, but under Rosemond and Vila and Pritchard, you need the full knowledge. And this is what the military judge appeared to be. His direct quote was that he was wrestling with this idea. So he says that he's wrestling it. That's at JA 243, Your Honor. And he also talks about this being a tricky subject at JA 246. So the military judge, with the evidence of the record, he was not convinced. The government's whole theory at trial was that appellant knew that Craig was going to go kill the victims. That was the government's theory, is that he knew that there's no other way to take the words, they got to go, except for the fact that the government in Craig's trial agreed to opposite meanings of that.
Correct, but we're dealing with the special findings of the military judge. So we've got the military judge saying he knew that he was going to confront him, and he knew he had a motive, and knew he was angry, knew he had a firearm, and so forth. So once the appellant, is found guilty of aiding and abetting, why isn't aiding and abetting an Article 128 violation?
Your Honor, because that's not what the military judge found.
But are you saying if the military judge specifically said you accused are guilty of the offense of Article 128 violation, would this be righteous at that point? So is it just that failure of the military judge to utter those words that caused this conviction not to be valid?
That's correct. It's the fact finder's job to find every element beyond reasonable doubt. Here, the military.
Okay, but finding the elements is different from what you seem to be saying right now, where you're saying because the military judge made findings that can be considered ticking off the elements. You're saying, I think, something a little bit different, that he then needed to come up with that conclusory determination that the appellant was guilty of this specific violation.
Yes, because he was charged with premeditated murder. So the military judge, under the aiding and abetting law, would need to find that the appellant, with full knowledge, intended to go there to commit that assault. If the deaths were foreseeable from them going there to commit an assault, that's now where we get into the LIOs of what he was actually charged
with. So let's get into that then. Do you agree with the legal concept that if someone aids and abets a criminal offense, that that aider and abettor is then also criminally culpable for the natural and probable consequences of the actor, so to speak, up to the level of the mens rea of the aider and abettor?
If they agree to go commit that offense to begin with, Your Honor, yes. Then if there's an agreement.
Who's the they in that sentence?
The perpetrator and the accomplice, the principal. And understanding that Article 77 merges everything into you are guilty to the same level as the perpetrator.
But what if you've got the situation where you've got an aider and abettor for a bank robbery, knows that the person is armed, he's the getaway driver, has no expectation of the actor shooting and killing a bank teller, but in fact the actor does that. Are you saying that unless there was an agreement ahead of time that, okay, I'm going to go in and shoot the bank teller, that the aider and abettor would not be guilty of the natural and probable consequences of the death of someone when someone goes into a bank to rob it with a firearm?
No, Your Honor, I'm saying that the opposite of that, Your Honor. I'm saying if you knowingly go to commit a bank robbery and you know the person is armed, it is foreseeable that a death could result from that bank robbery.
So how does that differ here? We've got an angry person with a motive going to confront someone. They have a firearm. They're not just going to slug somebody and somebody then dies from falling backwards. Got a firearm. Why then is the aider and abettor not responsible for the natural probable consequences up to the level of the mens rea of the aider and abettor?
Because on that fact pattern, Your Honor, the aider and abettor did not know they were going to commit a crime. Confronting someone on its own is not the crime.
Well, if you cause someone to reasonably apprehend, there's no requirement there. Personal safety, there's no requirement of actual force being used. That's the whole point of the hypothetical here. That's the whole point of Article 128. You still have an assault by offer. It's a criminal offense. And then, once you aid and abet criminal offense, there's this escalation clause.
But that's what the military judge needs to make that finding of the criminal offense under aiding and abetting law, because based off of what the full knowledge that the appellant thought the criminal venture was, that's what we're basing our foreseeability and our legal sufficiency review off of.
But we can't when we're doing that, we've got the military judge, going back to the point, saying not only that he knew that he was going to confront, he knew, the appellant knew, that Sergeant Craig would probably kill. So we have a finding there by the military judge of what the natural and probable consequence would be here.
But that's negligence language, Your Honor. The government prosecuted appellant under aiding and abetting where he needed the full knowledge.
Well, when we're talking about negligence, doesn't that get us into involuntary manslaughter? Isn't culpable negligence exactly the mens rea that applies there.
Not when the government specifically disclaims that theory of liability, when the defense brings up to the military judge that we're not on notice of that. That's when we're now doing appellate refinement of what was actually presented to the fact finder. The government at JA 253 to 254 specifically tell the military judge they are not prosecuting appellant as a perpetrator of involuntary manslaughter, that their whole entire theory of liability is based off of aiding and abetting.
Thrust of the question. Yeah. Judge Johnson, did you want to?
I was going to ask a question, but I guess the easiest way to do it is reconciling then U.S. v. Brown, because your answer falls directly into U.S. v. Brown, because in this instance, as you noted, the government charged and tried the appellant for aiding and abetting the premeditated murder. But the involuntary manslaughter is a lesser included offense. And so I guess I'm kind of with Chief that I'm not quite sure what you're challenging. You say that the military judge did not make a specific finding and that the culpable negligence standard, how do you reconcile U.S. v. Brown, which says that in a scenario like this, that the appellant can still be found guilty based upon their own actions of the separate involuntary manslaughter?
Harris, I'm running out of time. May I answer?
I have a feeling we're going to be going way over time here, yes. So please proceed.
So U.S. v. Brown is a guilty plea where the accused pled guilty to the culpable negligence. So U.S. v. Brown highlights the fact that the government controls the charge sheet, and there's multiple ways that they could have charged this case. They could have charged appellant for involuntary manslaughter by culpable negligence. They chose not to take that route. They swung for the fences. They wanted premeditated murder. That's the charge they went with. So the difference between this case and U.S. v. Brown is that in U.S. v. Brown, the accused's culpably negligent acts are what he pled guilty to, and one of the offenses, a theory that could have got to that finding. So the court did not have to consider that he could have been charged another way through accomplice liability, because the government in this case could have charged appellant differently and presented these facts to the fact finder to see if the appellant's own culpably negligent acts caused this crime.
But you seem to be arguing there that a trier of fact cannot find an accused guilty of a lesser included offense, that the government swung for the fences, and that therefore a trier of fact is handcuffed and can't find an accused guilty of an LIO.
No, when the LIO, so the appellant was on notice of an LIO through aiding and abetting. Mm-hmm. What the Army Court did here was affirm under perpetrator involuntary manslaughter. The government at trial specifically said they are not, an appellant is not on notice that he's defending against perpetrator liability for involuntary manslaughter.
Now you are sloshing between the two buckets. One is the trial court and what happened at the trial court, and then what happened before the CCA. I think what Judge Johnson is trying to home in on here is whether what happened at the trial court was righteous. So please separate what the CCA did from what happened with the military judge.
What happened at the trial court, everything was good up into the trial court, up until the point where the military judge made his special findings. Because appellant was on notice that he was being tried as an aider and abettor. Where the problem at the trial court happened was the military judge's special findings, because he failed to identify in his special findings what the offense that Specialist Thompson had full knowledge he was going to go do. That's the problem with the special findings, Your Honor. Moving to the next bucket, what the CCA did was The appellant's position has not changed on appeal at all. The appellant raised the same issue at the CCA, and the government at the CCA level said this was absolutely tried as an aider and abettor, and he was absolutely convicted as an aider and abettor. But then the Army Court saw the error in the special findings because the military judge never made that finding of a predicate offense or the knowledge on behalf of Specialist Thompson. So they read it into it that it was going to affirm that appellant was actually convicted as a perpetrator of involuntary manslaughter. But that is a theory, that's the exact theory that the government disclaimed on the record at trial that appellant did not have notice of. And that's when we get into the Ober and Chiarella problem, where we now have the CCA affirming on a different theory of liability than the military judge found on. Because the military judge adopted the aiding and abetting liability. In his special findings, he says, I find you guilty of aiding and abetting Sergeant Craig. So,
Captain Moore, let me ask you this. You seem to be taking issue with the fact that the military judge, or the result here, is that the accused was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter as a perpetrator. Is that when that wasn't the offense, he actually aided and abetted? Is that? I admit that I might be confused, but
the military judge convicted the appellant through an aiding and abetting lens.
Right, and you can aid and abet by assisting, and the conduct involved in the assisting, sometimes it amounts to a separate offense, but it need not, right?
Correct, Your Honor. But to assist, you also need that full knowledge piece. So the Supreme Court in Rosemont makes clear.
But in this case, I think the result tells us that you may not need full knowledge, and that's why the military judge drops down to the lesser included offense. And so let me ask you, are you saying that the accused needed to have actual knowledge as opposed to the objective standard of should have known under the negligence theory?
He had to have actual knowledge that they were going there that morning to commit a crime.
Right, but if in this case, the record seems to indicate that he may not have. So why isn't the lesser included offense a valid finding?
Because the military, the government did not try him as a perpetrator of involuntary manslaughter. So
right, but if involuntary manslaughter is a lesser included offense of the primary offense of premeditated murder, aren't you always on notice of a lesser included offense? You don't have to be separately advised on that, do you?
Your Honor, the defense was only on notice of the lesser included offenses through the lens of aiding and abetting.
Right.
Can you explain that? I mean, it seemed like it's a little inconsistent with what you previously said. I mean, it seemed like ordinarily you'd be on notice of all possible lesser included offenses. So that's, and we've said that satisfies due process. But previously you said, yes, but in this case, trial counsel disclaimed anything but the aider and abetting theory. And so the way I interpreted your statement before was the only reason that it couldn't be the perpetrator liability was because the government disclaimed perpetrator liability. Is that your position?
No, Your Honor, in the lens of the aiding and abetting and the LIO.
Well, let's just back up. Isn't generally the case that you're on notice that if you're charged with first-degree premeditated murder, you're on notice of all possible lesser-included offenses. If nobody says anything, you could be found guilty of anything that's a lesser-included offense. Nobody has to tell you, hey, we're going to go for this particular kind of lesser-included offense. But this case is, my understanding from your brief was this case is a little bit different because the government said we're not going down that direction.
Correct. The government specifically said that they are only pursuing aiding and abetting, and they are only they are not pursuing any perpetrator liability against the appellant. Because defense knew they were on a – I'm sorry, Jeff.
If they hadn't said that, then the military judge could have found him guilty under any lesser-included offense.
without any notice problem. Isn't that right? I mean, if the elements were satisfied.
If the elements were satisfied. But in this case, the charge was that Specialist Thompson committed the murder. Now, the way the government was proving that was through the aiding and abetting lens, because everybody knew that Sergeant Craig actually is the one who did the murders. So the government's entire theory from the start was that appellant aided and abetted him.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, the way we define, you know, with Article 77, it's basically you say that, you know, he didn't pull the trigger, but he still committed the murder. I mean, I think that seems like a pretty slender ground for distinguishing it, because it's just, it's a term of art the way it's pleaded. I mean, he still could have been found guilty of, I mean, if the elements were satisfied, of premeditated murder, even though it was pled a different way because of the way we define principles. Isn't that correct? I mean, I don't think it really matters how it was pled. I think what's important to me, it seems, is that ordinarily he would be on notice of all possible LIOs except if there's this government concession.
Well, in this theory, what he was actually convicted of, Your Honor, was through his acts. So it takes Sergeant Craig's murder, the actus reus of Sergeant Craig committing a murder, completely out of it. It's just, were Specialist Thompson's culpably negligent acts, did they cause the homicide? Was it foreseeable that what he did caused the homicide?
But that would be perpetrator. I'm sorry. I cut you off, and I didn't mean
to. No, go ahead.
Okay. Because I want to go back to something in response to Judge Sparks' question about the level of knowledge that the appellant needed. And you responded that the appellant needed to know that they were going there to commit a crime, which to me then goes back to the chief's question with regards to the level of knowledge, because really, and you know, I'm not that smart, so I had to map this out on the whiteboard. When you map out the elements of the aider or abettor under the premeditated murder and the elements of involuntary manslaughter as the perpetrator, because you're a principal either way, but as the perpetrator, the only difference is that shared intent under the aider and abettor provision. You track it with me?
Yes, sure.
Okay. So, and as you've argued, that although, you know, Supreme Court jurisprudence initially said it had to be the exact same intent as the trigger puller, but subsequent case law has said, no, the aider and abettor can have a lesser level of intent, and which you just articulated that essentially all he needed to know was that they were going there to commit a crime. So if we go back to the chief's question, that assault by offer is a crime, wouldn't that satisfy then or support this conviction under whichever theory you want to go with?
But that is an appellate substitution, Your Honor, for the finding, because the military judge did not find assault by offer. He found that they were probably going to kill. He never made that finding. So now we are using appellate substitution to find stuff for the military judge that he did not articulate into his special findings. We also have to take into account, too, that in additional charge 3, where the same overt acts were alleged against the appellant in a conspiracy to commit an armed assault, the military judge found him not guilty of that. So the military judge, for the appellate court to be able to affirm this conviction based off of what the military judge and the theory the military judge applied, was that appellant aided and abetted Sergeant Craig. But to do that, he needed to make a finding that there was a predicate offense. The military judge failed to make that finding. And that's why the findings on themselves fail. That's why they're legally insufficient, because the military judge did not make the required findings for the intent and the knowledge that was required for Specialist Thompson to be held liable as an aider and abettor.
So are you saying that the military judge needed to specifically make a finding that the accused was guilty of an Article 128 violation? Because a military judge in the special findings said that the accused knew that he was going to, that Sergeant Craig was going to confront with a firearm while angry the victim. So the elements are there. We're looking at the facts in the light most favorable to the government. The elements are there for an Article 128 violation. So are you saying that what the problem is the military judge failed to specifically invoke assault by offer?
Assault by offer or any crime, Your Honor, that we are now using appellate substitution to replace what the military judge did not make a finding of. So, yes, Your Honor, that had the military judge made different special findings?
But I want to be clear. Are you saying that if the military judge had simply said, therefore, he's guilty of aiding and abetting assault by offer, you would not have any problems with his conviction?
We would have a different argument to make on appeal than that the military judge did not make any finding of a predicate offense. We would then be talking about, is it foreseeable that the deaths would be a result of that?
Well, if you've got the military judge making a special finding that Sergeant Craig, that appellant knew that Sergeant Craig would probably kill the victims, where does that leave us?
Your Honor, that leaves us with the military judge not making a finding of what offense he thought and that he believed Specialist Thompson went there with full knowledge and full intent to go commit with Sergeant Craig. That leaves us with inadequate special findings that are legally insufficient.
Counsel, if the military judge hadn't made any special findings, just said guilty, we would then just simply ask, could a reasonable, for legal sufficiency, we'd just ask whether a rational trier of fact could have found the elements. And so if you make one special finding, then you've got to make all the rest. I mean, is there anything that the military judge found that was inconsistent, even if he didn't make a specific finding on that last, on that one specific fact? Because why aren't we just asking, could a rational finder of fact have found that?
Because the special findings have to matter, Your Honor. If this was a general finding, perhaps we're not here.
Well, they matter so far that they can't be contradicted, unless they're, you know, they can't be contradicted. I mean, they could find they're not factually supported, but they can't find it additional. They can't find facts that the military judge refused to fact or contradict them. But if the military judge only made a few special fact findings, that wouldn't preclude the rest of it. I mean, why wouldn't we be back just in the legal sufficiency world? I mean, the military judge helped out the appellate review process by finding some facts. But he didn't have to find any. And if he hadn't found any, we would just ask the question, could a rational trier of fact find these facts? And, of course, the CCA would have to find also that they were factually sufficient.
Well, the defense specifically requested the special findings in this case, Your Honor. So once that request was made, the military judge has to make his special findings. And his special findings have to support the crime of which he's finding him guilty.
Well, they didn't contradict it. He may just not have. But if he has a gap, that means he didn't find it? I mean, that's not usually how we look at it.
If he has a gap, if he didn't establish one of the core principles of accomplice liability, which is that there is a specific intent to go commit something and the full knowledge on the accused, that's a legally sufficient finding, Your Honor. Or legally insufficient finding, Your Honor.
Counsel, I want to clarify something. I thought you said a moment ago that the appellant was convicted for his own actions. But the way I read the special findings is he was convicted of aiding and abetting an involuntary manslaughter. Is that not how you read the special findings?
I read the special findings that he was convicted through aiding and abetting, through culpable negligence. The military judge is kind of conflating the two theories. The Army Court, though, affirmed that he was convicted of.
Well, don't you need both, though? I mean, like, you've got to satisfy all four elements of involuntary manslaughter, and to make him culpable for the deaths, since he's not the one who shot them, he's got to satisfy that element, he's got to use an aiding and abetting theory, right?
He'd have to use an aiding and abetting theory, but The way the findings read are, he specifically intended to be culpably negligent. The findings don't work through the aiding and abetting lens.
Well, can you not aid and abet a something that doesn't? So this gets weird, right? So we have, he gets charged with premeditated murder. It has an intent element. We have an LIO with a negligence element. They don't fit very well together, but that's the system we have. So, and it seems like the military judge satisfied the making him criminally liable for the deaths using an aiding and abetting theory. And then when he's doing the premeditated murder elements, he's like, well, you don't have the intent for premeditated murder, so I can't convict you of that. So I'm going to drop down to an LIO, to a culpable negligence. And we can have an argument about whether or not culpable negligence is really subsumed within intent, but it is here, and the defense asked for this LIO, so I think you're stopped from arguing it's not. But why not? Why can't? Isn't that what the military judge? And that's sort of how I read this. He satisfied you're criminally liable for the deaths because you aided and abetted, and then you don't have the intent for premeditated murder, so I'm dropping down to culpable negligence because I do think you were culpably negligent, right? And then we'll just assume that the specific intent for the aiding and abetting was involuntary manslaughter. Right? He didn't say that, but I think you might be able to infer that from his readings. What would be wrong with that theory?
Well, first, Your Honor, the military judge did not find the predicate offense. But then there's also the problem. So in the Rowden case, where we have the culpable negligence and the accomplice liability in there. The military judge in that case specifically instructed the panel that you're not to consider the aiding and abetting for the culpable negligence because they don't work together. You can't specifically intend to be culpably negligent. So the problem I see with that is that through the aiding and abetting lens, Your Honor, that Specialist Thompson had to know that they were going there to commit the crime. And
commit,
the military judge
commit a crime or the crime he's convicted of?
Commit a crime where it would be foreseeable that death could occur. So we'll use the 128 as an example in this case. If Specialist Thompson went with the intent and full knowledge that he knew that they were going there to commit an assault, then, and the military judge made all of these findings, then we're in the realm of Jackson of where, what is his culpability level? But the jurisprudence with the having different culpability levels doesn't get away from the fact that they went there to at least, there has to be a finding that there was a crime that was committed. And that's why through the aiding and abetting lens, which is what the military judge used, he adopted the government's theory at trial and used it in his special findings. But he failed to make those necessary knowledge and intent findings. We have this mixed match of...
What would you, if you were devising or putting or drafting an instruction, let's say this was a members' trial, what would you recommend as the language to be given to the members on this issue? Same facts, same setup. We're now down to the fact where you and the military judge and prosecutor are now deciding what the instruction should be. What would the proposed defense instruction look like from your standpoint on this particular issue?
So with the culpable negligent piece, Your Honor, since it's through the aiding and abetting of the premeditated murder, the instruction would have to be somewhere along the lines of the fact finder would need to find that Sergeant Craig's murders were not murders. They were done by culpable negligence. So we would get out of the premeditated world, and it would have to be found that the actual killings themselves were through culpable negligence by Sergeant Craig. Then we can start assessing Sergeant or Specialist Thompson's aiding and abetting of that culpably negligent homicide through the aiding and abetting.
Okay. Now, that sounds like what you're saying is that you can never be found guilty as an aider and abettor by assisting the perpetrator if your acts were only culpably negligent. Is that what the final outcome of the points you've made here today?
Can
You want me to say it again?
Can you repeat that again, Your Honor?
Are you saying that, and it sounds to me like you are, but correct me if I'm wrong, are you saying that in a case like this, you can never find the accused as an aider and abettor, in this case to premeditated murder, if the accused assistance as an aider and abettor only amounted to his culpably negligent conduct? And that seems to get at the point you're making about the mens rea requirements for the two offenses. You're right. You can't specifically intend a negligent act, for sure. But what is, I guess I'm stuck on why the accused conduct that amounts to culpable negligence cannot be considered conduct sufficient to assist under an aider and abettor theory, no matter what the perpetrator is charged with.
Well, I see the issue there, Your Honor, and this is where really the culpable negligence and aider and abettor, as the Army Court said, it may not be a perfect fit. It's really not a fit at all.
Okay, so you're agreeing with what I'm stating as the premise here.
As a premise, yes, Your Honor, that to be guilty as an aiding and abetting, the law requires full knowledge and purpose, that you seek for that criminal venture to succeed. If you're only culpably negligent and you don't really – your acts – you're not acting with full knowledge, then that kind of fails as a matter of logic.
But, again, isn't that the law? The law is that the aider and abettor can indeed be convicted of an offense in his aiding and abetting or assisting – that requires a different mens rea than the perpetrator.
A different mens rea, yes, Your Honor. And it can be a less mens rea, but there needs to be that concert of purpose where they are agreeing to commit a illegal act together.
Well, that sounds like a conspiracy analysis, but why would you need the aider and abettor theory why would you need a conspiracy allegation if you have the aider and abettor theory at work in this case? In fact, the military judge did not convict on a conspiracy theory.
We agree that you can be found guilty by a less culpable means or a more culpable means than the perpetrator. So if we take this fact pattern and if we use kind of the facts that were in play in Sergeant Craig's guilty plea, that he went there without the intent to kill anybody, and say he didn't have the gun, but Specialist Thompson had the gun. If the facts were that when the victim started calling his wife an improper name, and he got angry and were in heat of passion, and then Specialist Thompson said, "Here, take my gun and shoot this person." Now, Specialist Thompson would be more culpable. He would be guilty of, through aiding and abetting, of a higher culpability than that of Sergeant Craig, because he doesn't have the heat of passion. So it's kind of the opposite of what most of the case law kind of comes down at.
Well, it goes back to a question I asked earlier, at least, which is the conduct of the aider and abettor. It need not necessarily rise to a separate offense, does it? Under Article 77, it doesn't say you have to commit a separate offense as an aider and abettor. We're concerned or focused on the conduct of the aider and abettor and how he or she assisted the perpetrator, aren't we?
The aider and abettor has to assist in a criminal venture.
Yes, and that's what he's been convicted of, hasn't he?
I disagree that he's been convicted of that because the military judge failed to find that in his special findings.
All right. Well, I guess we'll leave it there. I'm and it could be me. It could be me. I remain confused, but I understand your position.
Any further questions from the bench? Seeing none, I would just note that except for death penalty cases, you win the award for the longest oral argument for the last dozen years that I'm aware of. And we'll hear back from you soon.
We'll see if Captain Schaefer beats me.
Captain Schaefer.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court. May it please the court. I'm Captain Nicholas Schaefer, and along with my co-counsel, Colonel Richard Guarini, we represent the United States. Appellant committed involuntary manslaughter by assisting his friend's killing of two soldiers. The special findings are legally sound and sufficient, establishing the necessary elements of involuntary manslaughter by culpable negligence, a proper lesser-included offense here. And there is neither an issue of variance on appeal nor a lack of notice at trial. Now, as a preliminary note, answering some of the points made by appellant. First, appellant said that the perpetrator theory of liability was expressly and completely disclaimed by the government. But if the court directs its attention to JA 250 and 251 specifically, the defense counsel objects and says, it seems like the government is arguing for a perpetrator theory of liability for involuntary manslaughter. And when the military judge asks, are you going to advance such a theory, government? Trial counsel comes back and says, yes, Your Honor. As outlined in the bench brief at the end, the theory was that the accused assistance constituted culpable negligence. And so again, the focus was on appellant's assistance and his mens rea, and answered explicitly that this was or could be defined as a perpetrator theory of liability. So as a preliminary note, the defense was on notice. From the bench brief that is found at, J343, this exchange on J251, and then in their closing argument specifically that the culpable negligence, the willful blindness of appellant constitutes or serves as the foundation for involuntary manslaughter, and that's JA 291.
So, counsel, essentially what you're arguing is that the question, similar to the question I posed to appellant's counsel, because when you do the elements side by side, the only difference between the aider and abettor under the premeditated murder and the lesser included offense of manslaughter, and charging the manslaughter directly, we'll use the term perpetrator, would be that shared intent or shared purpose. And so what you're saying is that what government was saying that, yes, it can be both. It's not an either or, it's an and both. That the appellant can be convicted of either the lesser included offense of the involuntary manslaughter, or based upon the appellant's act solely in assisting, he could be convicted under the 119B involuntary manslaughter as a perpetrator. I'm just trying to draw that distinction because with the Article 77, everybody's a principal, so that's not helpful. But
yes, Your Honor. If I'm understanding correctly, that is correct. That is the government's position. Article 77. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, I was going to say the and this goes back to with Rowden. You know that the actus reus remains the same in either one of those flavors. The actus reus is the same, and that the military judge in his special findings identified the five actions, listed the five actions that he said supported a finding that they were culpably negligent because it was a natural and foreseeable consequence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Actions. Okay.
That's exactly it. There are two foundational principles within, I believe, the question you just posed, is that it's well established and uncontested that involuntary manslaughter is a lesser included offense of premeditated murder. That's found by presidential direction in the MCM, that's found in this court's case law, and the parties agreed in this case that this was a lesser included offense. And the second, coming back to your point, Your Honor, is that Article 77 of the UCMJ eliminates that common law distinction between types of principles. An aider and abettor and a perpetrator are treated the same. They have the same culpability. They face the same punishment. The actus reus here remains the same, regardless of whether it was the aiding and abetting premeditated murder all the way down through the lesser included offenses to involuntary manslaughter. Is his acts of assistance, those five acts, driving him to the apartment, of checking the doorknob to see if the door was unlocked, of knocking or ringing the doorbell, of lying to get into the apartment and remaining there until Sergeant Craig entered.
Counsel, I just want to clarify. So for involuntary manslaughter, second element, that the death resulted from the act or omission of the accused, you could read that two ways. One, that he aided and abetted the acts of Sergeant Craig in killing the two people, or that his own acts and omissions, the probable, you know, the outcome of those was the deaths of the two victims. The government believes that which one of those is the way that he was convicted by the military judge?
Your Honor, it was his acts of assistance were the proximate cause. However,
okay, through an aiding and abetting theory?
Through aiding and abetting. Okay. So aiding and abetting, this is all under the umbrella of the first finding that the military judge makes. The finding is that Sergeant Craig, beyond a reasonable doubt, committed premeditated murder on March 5th, 2017, and killed. He did it with malice aforethought. And the acts of assistance, that first portion of Article 77, where it's the actus reus, he describes this as aiding and abetting. He gave that active assistance. This wasn't mere presence at the scene. This wasn't accidental assistance. Appellant was not an Uber driver. He was not someone who just happened to be there. Instead, he actively assisted. And then the question is, okay, he has actively assisted. He has aided and abetted. What is his level of mens rea?
Okay, so if we're in an aiding and abetting world, then I think what appellant's argument is he goes to Rosemond and he says, to aid and abet a crime, a defendant must not just in some sort associate himself with the venture, but also participate in it as something that he wishes to bring about and seek by his action to make it succeed. So what was the thing? What he's arguing about is that we don't know what the thing he meant to succeed was because the military judge didn't tell us. So what is the government's theory? What is the thing that he meant to succeed? He wasn't just associating himself with this venture. There was an outcome he wanted.
Yes, Your Honor. It is important to note that Rosemond is distinguishable from this case to a certain extent because it doesn't deal with lesser-included offenses. Instead, what it is looking at is, do you have the full actual knowledge of the charged offense? And so in that way, adopting the P&E standard is talking about doing something as something you wish. Now, the specific intent here was for the acts of assistance. And so there's not necessarily a requirement for involuntary manslaughter by culpable negligence to have a predicate offense. Now, as you pointed out, Your Honor, there are legally sufficient findings to show that there is an assault by offer that was found here. It may not have been explicitly titled as such, but the elements are met. And beyond what has already been pointed out of he had this knowledge of a confrontation, he had this knowledge of him being armed, of having the motive and opportunity to probably kill, it's also the special finding that he went in with no innocent purpose. This is wrongful, and it is stated so by the military judge. And so this isn't just something that that the military judge says was just a normal confrontation, just a conversation. He explicitly says he knew that he wasn't going in for just a conversation, just to talk to these guys. There was an explicit finding there. And also that this was foreseeable. This was a foreseeable result, is an explicit finding made by the military judge. So whether there needs to be a predicate offense or not, it's the government's position that there shouldn't have to be for involuntary manslaughter by culpable negligence. You look at this, these acts of assistance done knowingly and willfully, and then does the appellant here, does the aider and abettor have a criminally culpable mind at some level? And starting and going down, the government did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it met the same intent. But there doesn't need to be a matching intent, as is stated in this, the concurring opinion in U.S. v. Richards, is that it doesn't have to be a co-equal. And similarly, there was much made by the appellant of the knowledge, the full knowledge. There has to be full knowledge for the full offense. But the military judge here made significant findings on what he did know. And without belaboring the point, many of those have already been brought up, but the fact that Sergeant Craig intended to confront, that he had a motive to confront, that he was armed, and that all of this was facilitated by the knowing and willful assistance of appellant.
So that leads me, at least, to the question of the actions by the CCA.
Yes, Your Honor.
So as you noted in JA 251, there wasn't this disclaimer, but we have the military judge very clearly concluding that appellant was guilty on aiding and abetting theory, and then we have the CCA saying, that doesn't really fit. We're going to go with a different theory. Why doesn't that offend principles of due process, where an accused going up at the appellate level says, this is what I need to defend against? Let's say that they successfully defend against that, but then the appellate court says, we're going to use a different legal theory to conclude that you're guilty. How is that fair?
Your Honor, because the actus reus remains the same, and the only thing that goes up and down, just like with lesser included offenses, is the mens rea, this is consistent with U.S. v. Jackson. And U.S. v. Brown, while not completely factually similar, is instructive in this case as well, where you have, as is noted in the opinion, there was confusion at the beginning of the Providence inquiry. He was charged as an aider and abettor. They started by describing the law of principles and aiding and abetting, but then ultimately the facts and the theory presented to the fact finder was involuntary manslaughter by his own, by appellant's culpable negligence.
But why does that background noise matter? Why doesn't what matter being when the trier of fact makes specific findings and articulates, this is the legal theory which I am using to convict, and the accused then on appeal says, that's what I need to defend against, and the appellate court says, we're going to impose a different legal theory, and you lose under this one that you didn't know you had to defend against on appeal?
It's because it's not a different theory of liability, Your Honor. While they
now,
use
how is it not when you've got the CCA saying it doesn't really fit, we need to use a different theory? How is it then that, as in your argument in the brief, essentially say it's a difference without a distinction without a difference? Well, if there's no difference, why didn't the CCA simply affirm the approach that the military judge took with aiding and abetting?
The CCA simply titled the military judge's finding with slightly more precision. But whether this is boxed up and presented as aiding and abetting premeditated murder but with culpable negligence, or it is presented as involuntary manslaughter by culpably negligently assisting someone else's premeditated murder, the factual predicate is the same. The factual foundation remains the same. And so, similar to in U.S. v. Brown, where there was some initial confusion, but this was a theory presented to the fact finder. The government specifically said,
but it's not what the fact finder used. Yes, it was presented. That's my point. That's background noise, isn't it? Doesn't what matters is if the trier of fact specifically says, this is the legal theory I'm using, why isn't that what matters?
Your Honor, because the CCA didn't create any facts. They did not introduce something that is truly a fatal variance. It's not something that is truly different because the actus reus has remained the same. There's no transmogrification here.
So just to understand the contours of your argument, if on appeal to us, legal theories are laid out that go to the exact issue of guilt or innocence, the parties know what they're arguing, but then we come up with a completely different legal theory that goes to the issue of guilt or innocence, that's fine?
Your Honor, to answer that question, I would turn to the idea behind Chiarella versus the United States, where it was found that there was a different theory, but that's because it was a different offense. It was a different factual basis. And so whether this is titled as aiding and abetting or this is titled as involuntary manslaughter by culpable negligence, a perpetrator, the person who commits the lesser included offense is always going to be the perpetrator of that offense. Here, the murder, the trigger was still pulled by Sergeant Craig. And that never changes. And just because someone is a proximate cause of something, that's simply finding a sufficient connection, the foreseeable consequences of his own acts. It does not mean that all of a sudden Sergeant Craig disappears. Instead, and the military judge specifically
said, I guess my point is, when it is the due process concern about knowing what you have to defend against, why shouldn't appellant's counsel have had the ability to argue, contrary to you, on that point before the CCA, rather than the CCA imposing that approach itself, without the opportunity for that to be litigated at that level?
It's simply that idea within U.S. v. Rowden, which is persuasive in this case, is that it is a distinction without a difference, because the theory of the government did not change and it was something presented to the fact finder. It's appropriate for the CCA. Here they are refining, but they are not changing. They are not creating something different.
So it doesn't matter that appellant's counsel didn't have an opportunity to address your argument of it's a distinction without a difference.
Your Honor, the appellant did address this at the CCA. Is that this was their argument, is that it was a perpetrator theory of liability that was found by the military judge. And because, so clearly they were on notice at that time, because that was their sole argument, is that that's what the military judge found, even though he titled it as aider and abetter. One of the times he says vicariously liable, and so that does apply, as Your Honor has stated. But the other time he's talking about aiding and abetting in terms of the actus reus. He's saying he aided and abetted by doing those five acts. And so he's talking about that first step under Article 77, and then going to the mens rea. And then ultimately he finds, as the government has presented, as they argued, that he is a perpetrator here. But whether you call him a perpetrator, it's always through the lens of Sergeant Craig committing this murder and this being his acts of assistance. And so while it may be a proximate cause, it's not the only cause. It may not even be the main cause. It is just a but-for cause. It is something that channels through. And in U.S. v. Richards, the court decided that involuntary manslaughter was not an appropriate lesser-included offense in that case because it was not reasonably raised by the facts. But in this case, it is. This is not someone kicking someone while someone else simultaneously and unknowingly to them is stabbing them. This is him leading him to. This is him facilitating that opportunity. And so this was appropriate by the Army Court, while they titled it slightly differently. They are finding the same thing. It is still within the same lens, the same factual foundation, and there was no issue with notice at trial or on appeal, as we have stated.
Counsel, before you conclude, when we were talking about Rosemond earlier, you had mentioned that it didn't deal with lesser-included offenses. But it doesn't on the facts, but it does have something to say about it. It says, a person aids and abets a crime when he intends to facilitate that offense's commission. An intent to advance some different or lesser offense is not, or at least not usually, sufficient. So that might just go to whether or not he had the sufficient intent to commit premeditated murder. But we'd still need to find that he had the intent to commit, or the appropriate intent, if you want to call that, the appropriate mens rea to commit the involuntary manslaughter, right?
Correct, Your Honor. He would still need to rise to the level of a culpably negligent state of mind. And that was found here. It was a foreseeable consequence that these deaths would occur. And it was a culpable disregard for those consequences.
And we would have to infer that from the, since the military judge didn't say it, we would have to be able to, the government's position is we could infer it from the special findings? That the military judge found that he had the appropriate mens rea for involuntary manslaughter?
I see my time has expired, if I may.
Please respond.
If, Your Honor, if you're saying that there needs to be some sort of predicate offense, then yes, that would be something that is there in the elements. It may not have been explicit that it was Article 128, but in terms of his mens rea for involuntary manslaughter, the same mens rea that would be required if Sergeant Craig had been convicted of involuntary manslaughter, it's culpable negligence, and that is exactly what was found within these special findings.
Any further questions from the judge?
If you'll indulge me, Chief.
Absolutely.
If we change the facts a little bit in this case, suppose that as far as the knowledge, the accused meets with the perpetrator. Here's whatever the perpetrator is saying. But suppose in this case he simply drives him to the location and says something to the effect, hey, man, I don't know what you're going to do, but you're here, get out of my car. I'm going back to church. How does that affect this case, that change in the facts? How might it have affected this case? In other words, how far down the line do you have to go in your assistance or alleged assistance?
And in this hypothetical, Your Honor, he has the exact same knowledge?
Yeah, he still has everything that all the knowledge he had when he meets up with the perpetrator in this case, except he simply drives him to the location and then says, hey, look, go do what you need to do. You take care of your own business. I'm going back to church.
I think with that additional factor,
which might be an odd thing to do, but
I think under those facts, it still could be sufficient for involuntary manslaughter by culpable negligence. It would not be as strong because it wouldn't be supported by all of those acts, the active assistance, continuing to participate in being part of this. And it would also be that additional statement of, I don't know what you're going to do. That may just be disclaiming, that may just be covering himself, but that is an additional fact that would have to be taken into account by the fact finder. Mm-hmm. So it could come out differently, but in this case, there are much stronger facts in terms of both his knowledge. It may not have been full knowledge of everything Sergeant Craig was going to do, but he knew a significant amount, and he continued to assist him with that culpably negligent state of mind.
Thank you, Chief.
Absolutely. Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Captain Schaefer. Did you want to briefly conclude?
If I may briefly conclude, yes. Your Honor. There's no substitution here. The military judge found appellant guilty of involuntary manslaughter by culpable negligence, a proper lesser-included offense of aiding and abetting premeditated murder. And there was plenty of notice, no shift in theories because the actus reus remained constant and only the mens rea changed. Therefore, this court should affirm the military judge's findings.
Thank you. Captain Moore.
Your Honor, to the notice piece, the government cites to JA 251. If you keep reading to JA 253 and 54, that's where the defense says, we are not on notice of appellant being, the government's theory being perpetrator liability. When that was said, the government didn't say, it's a distinction without a difference. They didn't say, oh, no, you're absolutely on notice of that. That was our theory the whole time. They agreed that their theory was aiding and abetting. It wasn't until the Army Corps issued its opinion that appellant and the government knew he was prosecuted as a perpetrator for involuntary manslaughter. For those reasons, the findings are legally insufficient and should be dismissed. Pending any questions, Your Honor.
Any questions? Nothing? Seeing nothing, thank you, Captain Moore. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
The court stands adjourned until further order of the court.